Hey everybody, welcome to Voices from the Front Lines. This is your host, Eric Mann. Today we're going to be talking with Lynn Lyman of the Drug Policy Alliance about something that sounds civil asset forfeiture abuse, but it's a very, very serious thing about how the police essentially seize assets and then abuse them. So I'm going to learn as I go. I know it's bad. And the Drug Policy Alliance, by the way, is on a roll. I'm going to ask Lynn about a lot of the moves. The head of the DEA is resigning. So I work with their public relations person, Tony Newman, and I'm getting so many emails. They must be just moving on all cylinders. So we're going to start with Lynn Lyman. Then I'm going to read a tribute to my friend, Michelle Pritchard, All Power to the Long Distance Runner. Tonight, the Liberty Hill Foundation is having a dinner, and she'll be among the guests honored. And then we're going to continue to go with the phones, because I'm just learning a lot from our listeners. And since this is public radio, and it's sort of, I think, increasingly more of a talk show to me, not just an interview show, I learn a lot from all of you. So if you listen to us and learn a lot from Lynn and hopefully learn something from me, then the second half of the show, thanks to Stan, we're going to go on the boards and 818-985-5735. Call KPFK and let's talk. So let's start with Lynn Lyman. Lynn, are you on the phone?
I'm here. Good to be with you today, Eric.
First of all, just tell our listeners, first of all, a little bit about Drug Policy Alliance. Obviously, I started to know it through my friend Stephen Gutwillig, but I've just been learning a lot. And so start with that, Lynn, and then we'll get to the specific projects you're working on.
Sure. So the Drug Policy Alliance is a national organization trying to end the war on drugs. And we work in three different policy areas, doing policy and advocacy changes at the state and federal levels. So we work on marijuana law reform, we work on criminal justice and sentencing reform, and harm reduction, reducing the harms through a public health approach to drug use. And so our work falls in those three areas. We have a state team here in California that I head up. We have teams in other states. And then we, of course, have the work we do at the federal level.
Well, one thing, Lynn, is I've been following Drug Policy Alliance, and as you end up starting, of course, only as big a question of ending the war on drugs, which takes you into racism, takes you into the police, takes you into public health. Obviously, the mandate keeps expanding as the disease of the society expands. So you're only the statewide coordinator in California to deal with 100 things. So let's start with the issue of what is the abuse that you're trying to stop?
Well, and this is in relation to the asset forfeiture bill. We have other bills that I'd love to talk about as well.
Okay.
But SB 443 by Senator Hawley Mitchell is a bill to reform civil asset forfeiture here in California. And essentially, at the most basic level, it just requires California law enforcement agencies to follow California law, which they don't do when it comes to asset forfeiture. They follow federal law, which is much looser than California law. So some of the things the bill would do specifically, it would require conviction before forfeitures can move forward. Those two F words trip me up. It changes the distribution of the forfeiture proceeds. So right now, under federal law, 80% of the funds seized come back to that local law enforcement agency. Under California law, that would be 65%. It gives the right to counsel. Most people who have their property and their cash seized under this law are poor, low-income folks. Often immigrants, and there is no right to court-appointed counsel under asset forfeiture. So we put that back on the books.
So the police come in, right, mm-hmm. and they take your stuff, right? Like, what
yes.
do they take?
Well, they can take whatever they want, and there's a really low threshold when it comes to civil asset forfeiture. So unlike criminal law, where there's due process, you have to have a warrant, etc., under civil asset forfeiture laws, pretty much with reasonable suspicion, you can stop someone, take their assets, their car, their cash, their boats, their, you know, paintings, whatever you want, without having to prove that they're guilty of a crime.
Wow. And what's the law trying to change?
Well, Well, and the basis of civil asset forfeiture was supposed to be to stop drug pens, you know, and so to sort of undermine large drug cartels and other drug selling organizations. But what it ends up doing in practice is just harassing regular people as they're driving about or in their homes with you know, going around the justice system. So our law is trying to rein in these abuses. And the abuses are happening at a couple of different levels. Like I said, federal law is much looser, and so there's an abuse just in that the California police departments are saying, well, we're going to do this with the feds so we don't have to follow California law. But then even under federal law, we found with this report we released today that there are violations of federal law going on in these departments up and down California, the worst offenders being a cluster of smaller cities in L.A. County, like La Vergne and Vernon, Pomona, Beverly Hills was in there.
Well, I think one of the problems in listening to this that I'm concerned about is that on one level, I mean it, what you're doing is very important, and obviously that's why you're on the show. On the other level, I don't see how changing a law, for instance, if you're talking about undocumented people, they have almost no legal rights to start with. Then you have the fact that the legal system requires having a lawyer in order to say that they violated the law. And we know, as we're working in the high schools, as we work, you and I are working together on a lot of this stuff, the number of violations by the police, if we picked every law, hypothetically, that the police were violating, you and I could be litigating, you know, 70 aspects of a human being's life. So obviously, you're very strategic. You know, you pick your fights. Why is this an important fight? Because I don't think anything we're going to pass is going to stop the police state. So the question, you know, I think we have to either stop the police state or not stop the police state, you know what I mean? But we can't piecemeal it one piece at a time. On the other hand, our organization took on truancy. So obviously we did believe there's a piece of the action, you know? So help me understand why you picked this fight. Maybe that's what I'm trying to get to.
Sure, but even before that, let me say that, you know, we believe that we can piecemeal this one law at a time, and that's exactly what we do. Last year, we, you know, with Senator Mitchell again, we passed SB 1010, which eliminated the sentencing disparity between crack and powder cocaine. Really important. It's a small piece of mass incarceration and racial disparity in California's criminal justice system, but it's a really important piece. And, you know, and I could list all the other pieces we're trying to get at. One of the, you know, in a moment I'll talk about the other bills we're doing to protect immigrants. But why we choose asset forfeiture, we've been working on this for years. It is one of the, really the worst excesses of the war on drugs. You know, in the United States, we pride ourselves on our judicial system. You know, you need a warrant to break into somebody's house, even though we know police often don't have that. But according to the law, you need that. And this is a special carve-out that really gives law enforcement agencies free rein under the law, even when they're not violating sort of the constraints of that free rein. And this comes to the probable cause issue. You know, under federal law, the government can seize your property. They only need to show probable cause. It's the lowest standard of proof in the judicial system.
Well, let me ask you this. Please. No, please go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that, you know, in order to get your property back, you would need a high paid lawyer. Again, you don't get court-appointed counsel. And so most people, they just have their stuff grabbed. Now, what we saw happening in LA County cities was not as much of the taking the homes and the cars as we used to see in the 80s and the 90s. What we see happening are low-level cash grabs. So they pay an informant to tell them where a drug deal is going to go down. They wait until the drug deal has gone down, and then they follow the seller and seize the seller's money. They never bring the case to court, and nothing happens. You know, the person goes off, loses their money. They're not going to fight to get their money back. They were selling drugs anyway. And in this way, the police departments are really either padding their agency budgets or supplanting from the money that, you know, the city council has reduced in their budget, which is explicitly forbidden under federal law, the supplanting piece.
And how much percentage do you think that the police are pocketing themselves?
Well, we don't know that because neither the state attorney general here in California or the federal government are doing the kind of auditing and reporting that should be happening. So nobody really knows. And this report that we put out, investigative journalist Jonah Engel spent years collecting this data. No one has ever done this kind of in-depth look at a, you know, agency by agency seizures and, you know, how much they took and what it went to. So this is really first of its kind. The federal government has never done anything as exhaustive as what we just did.
Well, that's one of the things I like about the Drug Policy Alliance is the level of research that you do. I mean, you have to document a lot of stuff, right? So how do people find the report? Because I want to also get to the change in the DEA in a minute. So tell us about the report and how do we get that?
So the report is called Above the Law, an investigation into civil asset forfeiture in California. And it can be found at drugpolicy.org and right in / California. It's on the front page there. You can also do a search by asset forfeiture. So there's lots of ways to find it once you're on our website.
Great. And I know, Lynn, that you're running the whole state. But right now, you're also, I'm sure, involved in this whole fight over what's going on inside the DEA. One reason I have on the show is I can learn stuff. So tell me more about what is happening inside the DEA, because there's another Drug Policy Alliance press release that just came out today that I got. Could you help? There's a possible resignation. What's the internal fights about? Help us understand politically your assessment of the situation.
Well, and I have to preface with I'm not an expert on what happens at the federal level. As I see it, I have a state of 40 million to be concerned about. So I let my colleagues in D.C. worry about the federal stuff. But Michelle Lionheart has been, a problem from our perspective since the beginning. She's been, you know, heading the DEA since 2007. She's come under criticism numerous times for different issues. The issues we have and the concerns we have as reformers with her are distinct from some of the ones that she's been publicly criticized for. But this really comes down to the issue of the sex parties at some of the international embassies that, you know, have been under investigation, and there's been a lot of news about them. But essentially DEA agents hiring prostitutes while they're doing their work in Colombia and elsewhere, and this was exposed about a year or two ago, and finally it's sort of coming to a head, and we're happy to hear that she will probably be resigning. As of a few days ago, the president was standing by her. We've always had issues with her when it comes to classification of marijuana as a Schedule I defense, as just the approach of the DEA in persecuting and prosecuting medical marijuana businesses and patients in medical marijuana states, despite the administration saying that that's not something they were going to do. So we've had all kinds of issues with her around her resistance to reform and her deaf ear to, you know, the changes that pretty much everybody are beginning to accept as norm.
You're listening to Lynn Lyman, who she's only reduced her work to 40 million people in California because she wants to take a smaller piece of the action. So we're really impressed by the work she does. But I want to stay, and she's with the Drug Policy Alliance. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines. 818-985-5735. We're going to go to the phones in about 4:30. 818-985-5735. Lynn, I mean, it's ironic, of course, that, we make all these reform efforts to change an agency like the DEA, and then somebody falls because the agents were hiring prostitutes, which is
right.
So fundamentally not, I mean, of course, it's classic, but, you know, hardly the central issue facing our society. Tell us more about the contradictions inside the Obama administration between what I felt has been a lot of mixed messages about decriminalization, criminalization. Is there a internal struggle inside the administration about its inability to curtail its own DEA? Is that one of the problems?
You know, I imagine that there is, and that I would extend that also to their inability or their unwillingness to curtail the U.S. attorneys. And, of course, based on what happened under the Bush administration with sort of the micromanaging of the U.S. attorneys, I think the Obama administration has been even more careful about not micromanaging them. So the DEA has just been problematic, you know, overall. The U.S. attorneys across the country, every U.S. attorney, you know, sort of does things differently in their jurisdiction based on their feelings. So despite the fact that the Department of Justice issued what's often called the Cole Memo, which said that, you know, they won't interfere in medical marijuana states or in states that have legalized for recreational purposes, you still have U.S. attorneys across the country doing that. You know, one of the worst offenders being U.S. Attorney Melinda Haig in Northern California, who continues to, you know, wage war against medical marijuana businesses that are not only sanctioned by their municipalities, but considered major partners of their municipalities, Harborside in Oakland and Berkeley Patient Groups in Berkeley. So now you have, and DPA is on the legal team for both cities battling the federal government in court. The cities are defending those medical marijuana collectives or businesses.
Well, let's.
I think there is a real difference of opinion amongst the administration, and they're walking that dance between, you know, not overstepping their role, but trying to have a coherent policy.
Again, the voice you're listening to is Lynn Lyman. She's the state director of the Drug Policy Alliance. The other voice you're hearing is Eric Mann. I'm the host of Voices from the Front Lines. And I think one thing I wanted to talk to you about, Lynn, is that, you know, obviously Stephen Gutwilg is a very both good friend of mine and colleague, and we've known each other in his work with Outfest. He worked for the Labor Community Strategy Center. I also knew him with the Cornerstone Theater Group. And when Steve and I talk a lot about DPA, one of the things I'm struck by has been, I think, an evolution of a social justice perspective that I felt maybe even 5 years ago was more on the margins, which is to say we're against the drug policy, you know, we're against the war on drugs, which also has a lot of racist elements to it, whereas it's changed to being, I think, a much more coherently, if I can say, anti-racist perspective that it's more central to the DPA's assessment. Do you think that's a fair assessment of some evolution of your own organization's thinking?
I think that is fair, and I've been here for 3 years, and I came here rooted in a racial justice, social justice agenda, and that's why I'm here doing the work I'm doing. So by the time I got here 3 years ago, they had really embraced that as the framework, as mass incarceration and racial disparities as really the drivers of. Or the war on drug as the war on drugs as the drivers of race, racial disparities and mass incarceration. So I can't really speak to the time before I was here, but as an outsider in the criminal justice reform movement, before the past 3 years that I've been here, I'd agree that Drug Policy Alliance has moved towards sort of really openly embracing racial justice as part of its core mission.
Yeah, so I'll take the responsibility. That's my assessment.
Okay, you can have it.
How's that? I'll make it as a statement, not a question. And I think in the good sense, I mean, what I'm saying is I think, you know, Stephen, I think we have to give Michelle Alexander a great deal of credit. I mean, the role of intellectuals, the role of a black woman intellectual who, you know, she wasn't the first person who had the idea, but she did the very best job of constructing maybe a worldview that reached so many different people about that mass incarceration is the policy and that drug war is not the policy. You know what I mean? The drug war is a tactic in a broader strategy of war on gangs, war on drugs, war on crime, war on everything, which is mainly a war on black and brown people. And I think that in watching DPA's work and Aisha Bondelli, who I also know for many, many years, I just think I've really enjoyed the organization's evolution, let me put it that way, and I've always supported it. But I think what's important about this, since we all work together, is that, you know, we're focusing right now in our own organization about trying to end the Federal Defense Department's 1033 program, which is unbelievable. It's giving military grade weapons to the Los Angeles
police.
To the school police. And right now we've drafted a letter that's going out very soon to school superintendent Cortinas, who has defended having 61 M16 rifles owned by the school police when the M16 was actually the both the International Red Cross and other human rights organizations think the whole weapon should be outlawed, but let alone the concept that it would be used against school children or their parents. So we have a lot of pieces, you know what I mean, big, big pieces that we're working together in the... So one thing I want our listeners to understand is that one reason this may work is because a lot of us are biting different pieces of this monster. You know what I mean? Each of us are grabbing relatively large pieces, but we are trying to develop some greater sense of movement. So the reason we have DPA on, besides that we think they're good, is because they're an important piece of the puzzle, you know, and their work is an important piece, and we at the Labor Community Strategy Center work closely with them. So let me end with an important observation. What did you think of the show Weeds? How's that?
I don't watch it.
It's gone. It's gone. Did you ever watch it?
I watched a couple of episodes and didn't really like it, you know. Kind of like Orange is the New Black or The Wire. Some of these shows that are about things that are real serious subjects that you deal with during, you know, your working hours aren't really the best way to kind of relax and unwind in front of the television at night.
That's a really great concept. I never thought of that. That's why I watch ESPN. But then I go on ESPN and I listen to this. Did you hear about this woman who excoriated this poor other woman who she was at some service, like maybe renting a car, and she's a famous news reporter, and she just attacked this poor woman, you know, viciously. But she got in the new There Is No Privacy. She got caught, so she told the woman, "Don't you know I'm a movie star? You are terrible." She made horrible statements about the woman's character. My point is that we can't escape it. That even when I go to escape,
yeah.
even when I
yeah.
go on the sports shows, there are other social issues. So we'll end with this, Lynn, that what's the level of listener participation that you would want? Yeah, at Voices from the Front Lines, we're on 818-985-5735. After Lynn goes off, I'm going to read this tribute to my friend Michelle Pritchard, who's being honored tonight, and then we are going to go on the phones. I'd be interested in several things to listen to. Have you yourself been victims of the drug war? Have you yourself, for instance, had your own property confiscated? Since Lynn's talking about a major issue facing society, have you had this happen to you? 818-985-5735. What's the best way if people, you know, I mean, obviously you're primarily an advocacy in the best sense of the word. You're not a mass membership organization, but how could people work with you if they wanted to?
Yeah, no, we would love for people to sign up for our listserv. They can just go to drugpolicy.org, put in their email and their zip code, and then when we have bills like this that are moving through, and we'll often ask our members, and we are a member organization, so we'll often ask our members to you know, make phone calls to their representatives. So that the best thing people can do is to go to our website, sign up. We don't send millions of emails, but, you know, we will send, like, the DEA, the head of the DEA resigning. We sent that out today to our full list. So things that are of interest to people who care about ending the war on drugs.
Well, I do. I mean, I'm on all your listservs, and I seem to have an infinite capacity to enjoy emails. I do. I actually read my email. I mean, I don't like a lot of stupid stuff, but when important things come, it's probably the main source. I don't read the paper as much as I used to. And so I like what I'm saying to our listeners is getting on their listserv is pretty good. They send out really interesting stuff. They're doing really interesting work, and they're succeeding a lot. So, Lynn Lyman, thank you. Of course, please.
Our twin bills that are attempting to get at the issue of immigrants being deported for drug offenses.
Please, I would really like that a lot. 818-985-5735. Do start queuing up, because I do want to go on the phones in about 10 minutes. Go ahead, Lynn. I'd like to hear that a lot. about immigrants.
Sure. So we have a twin set of bills, AB 1351 and 1352, by Assemblymember Eggman. And what these bills do is they try to address the gap between state and federal law. Under federal law, any drug offense is considered a deportable offense, even
wow.
if you're a lifelong permanent resident of the United States. So whether California reduces marijuana to an infraction or possession of cocaine to a misdemeanor, it is still a deportable offense under federal law. And so our bills this year are trying to close that gap, and I think it's really important given our, you know, rich immigrant community that they're not essentially receiving unequal treatment under the law.
And are immigrant rights groups actively involved in this? Is there any...
Oh, yes. Yes, yes, yes. We are co-sponsoring this bill with the Immigrant Legal Resources Center, with CIRLA, and with a few others. So this is it's a great moment for the immigrant rights community and the drug policy community to come together, really for the first time on a bill in California.
Well, I think another, in my opinion, this is Eric Mann on Voices from the Frontlines. I'm talking to Lynn Lyman, the State Director of the Drug Policy Alliance. I think another thing that's changed is that there were, you know, within every movement, there are contradictions. So I know there were forces inside the immigrant rights movement that might have said, well, do we really want to touch a drug issue because that's, you know, maybe one of the stereotypes and we want to stay on safer issues like, you know, public health? And do we really want to say that if a person is convicted of a drug, you know, that we want, do we want to integrate that into a, immigrant rights perspective? I'm not saying that there weren't already people that believed that, but I think it's another example of the changing ideological frame, that people are more willing to integrate that the war on drugs and the war on immigrants are, again, two sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
And as a result, I think it's creating more, whatever you want to call it, synergy between, again, grasping the war on drugs as a social justice issue. And that's very exciting that you're working together with immigrant rights groups.
It really is. Really exciting.
Well, Lynn Lyman, thanks so much for making the time. Really great to have you on the show. Last way that we can just tell us again, how do we reach you and how do we get on that listserv again? Because I think it's very worth doing.
So www.drugpolicy.org, and then it says sign up. You put in your email and your zip code, and that way you'll get the California-specific pieces. I encourage your listeners who are on Twitter to follow me on Twitter. Twitter is my favorite medium of communication. I'm at Lynn Lyman, and Drug Policy Alliance is at drugpolicy.org on Twitter. So lots of ways to find us.
Well, I'm an Eric Mann Speaks, and nobody sends me a damn thing. So
I'm gonna go follow you right now.
All right. Well, that would be good, and I can read it on the air, and I could prove that somebody tweeted me or whatever you're supposed to have done. So, Lynn Lyman, really nice to have you at Eric Mann Speaks, at Lynn Lyman. We'll talk again, Lynn.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Take good care of yourself. So, everybody, this is Voices from the Frontlines, 818-985-5735. Stan from the engineering department has been nice enough. He's coming on the line. So here's what we're going to do. I'm very excited about the work of Drug Policy Alliance. I really am. And I'm in some way more excited about Drug Policy Alliance than even the specific things they do, which is also great. So we had a chance for you to get to know the thinking of a social justice organizer. I very much want to hear from you, 818-985-5735. Let's talk a little bit about the war on drugs, the issue of forfeiture of property. Have any of you have experience with the police around the war on drugs? Essentially, have they brought the war on drugs against you? We just were in a long conversation with Lynn Lyman, the State Director of Drug Policy Alliance, talking about a whole bunch of bills, including the issue basically that the police take your stuff and don't give it back. It's called civil forfeiture. We were also talking about the fact that any drug infraction, even the most minor, is a deportable offense for immigrants, which is not shocking since walking down the street is pretty much a deportable offense for immigrants. We want to hear from you at 818-985-5735 to respond to both the discussion of the war on drugs and also to respond to the commentary I'm about to make. So if you could start queuing up, my friend Stan is here, and he feels like the Maytag repairman where nobody's calling in, so what's the point of his job? Now, interestingly, since you guys have been so great, women and men, when we had our last fund drive, by the way, we raised $2,515, which is pretty wonderful. Alan Minsky and I and Zubri Fields worked together on that. So I want to thank you all. You're obviously out there. I love the listeners to Voices. So I'd like to hear some of you queuing up now at 818-985-5735 so we can talk to each other. In fact, we'll just make it open mic. So how's that? You can talk about pretty much whatever you want, as long as you get right to the point and say something interesting, funny, and profound, okay? So I'm going to read you now a commentary about my friend Michelle Pritchard. Again, tonight at the Beverly Hilton Hotel, the Liberty Hill Foundation, which is a foundation that gives a lot of money to grassroots organizations, civil rights organizations, low-income organizations, gives money, I think, to the Drug Policy Alliance, does give money to my own organization, the Labor Community Strategy Center, and so many others. So I'm going to tell you about my friend Michelle Pritchard. It's called All Power to the Long Distance Runner. Tonight, at a Center of Revolution in L.A., the Beverly Hilton Hotel, the Liberty Hill Foundation will be honoring Michelle Pritchard, a dear friend, and much more importantly, a key figure in the past, present, and future of Move and Building in Los Angeles in the U.S. Well, of course, the location reflects the contradictions of our times. It's for me one of the turning points in my own life in L.A. labor history. First here, in 1986, where I led the negotiations with, and yes, against, GM President F. James McDonald to keep the GM Van Nuys plant open. With our labor community coalition to keep GM Van Nuys open, of which I was the chair, on UAW Local 645, where I worked as an assembly line worker, we built a movement to stop GM from closing our plant. With the on-the-ground threat of a boycott of GM cars in Los Angeles County, the largest car market in the United States, we made GM an offer they could not refuse. We convinced McDonald to keep the plant open for 3 years longer after he had threatened to close it. For as he wisely observed, I do not like boycotts. I don't think they're good for business. Thanks to the work of the amazing president of UAW Local 645, the late Pete Beltran, a truly gifted shop floor leader, Mark Masaoka, the late Reverend Frank Higgins, the late Father Luis Olivares, Maxine Waters, Rudy Acuna, and 25 other key leaders, we forced GM, against its wishes, to keep the GM Van Nuys auto plant open for what turned out to be 10 full years. Keeping 5,000 auto workers, 50% Latino, 15% Black, and 15% women working before the deindustrialization of America broke the back of the Black and Latino well-paid working class in L.A. and throughout the U.S. 818-985-5735. I'm glad to see some of you going to the phones. This wonderful movement, led by auto workers and a Black and Latino community, is captured in a great film, Tiger by the Tail, produced by filmmaker Michael Goldman and funded by the Funding Exchange in New York and the Liberty Hill Foundation of Los Angeles. I know, what does this have to do with Michelle Pritchard? It's getting there. Back in the day, Paula Litt, representing the foundation, met with us and understood the importance of our work. So GM Van Nuys, the Beverly Hilton, the UAW, Paula, Liberty Hill, Rudy, Mark, me, and Michelle all go back seemingly forever. It is that sense of history and long-distance runners and long-distance friendships that are so key to understanding our present period and how important it is to understand Michelle's role in all of this. I really don't know where Michelle began in all of this, probably in preschool. Was it with the nuclear freeze or even before? And yes, the threat of nuclear weapons is one of the most understated dangers of our time. I remember her working with Barry Commoner for president, and her introduction to me, along with Sam Hurst, my brother-in-law, who worked with the Campaign for Economic Democracy, of Barry's critical understanding that the key to environmental possibility required challenging capitalism's structure of consumption and production, and building a red-green alliance based on Dr. King's movement to challenge racism, poverty, and militarism. This is Eric Mann. I'm on Voices from the Front Lines. Give me a call at 818-985-5735. I remember dinner at El Trollo, where Michelle brought me to meet a prominent anti-nuclear figure who talked at us for 2 hours and didn't seem to notice we could not get a word in edgewise, as my mom would say. After which Michelle made her ironic and iconic observation of well-meaning windbags who she deemed, quote, one-way communicators. She was the driving organizational force with Eugene Boutillier and clergy and laity united for economic justice. Our folklore together includes the role she played in helping me create the legal basis for the Strategy Center and helping me step by step overcome my actual phobia of filling out forms of incorporation. Just as I began as the director of the Strategy Center on January 1, 1989, Michelle began as the director of the Liberty Hill Foundation. Our paths have been intertwined ever since. She, Anthony Thigpen, Gloria Romero, Gil Cedillo, Peter Olney, Jorge Garcia, Rudy Acuna, Leanne Hurst Mann, were on the first organizing board of the Strategy Center and were my mentors in navigating the transition from a social movement to a movement institution. The center began literally underground in the basement of the Capital Bank building in Van Nuys. Ironic that an anti-capitalist project would begin not just in a bank, but in one called Capital, not Das Kapital. It's hard for folks to understand the bonds between many of us who have spent so much of our lives building the movement in LA together. After the urban rebellion of 1992, Michelle played a critical role in bringing a group of us together to see about the possibility of a unified response to corporate co-optation and police repression. Out of that came the Urban Strategies Group, in which Anthony Thigpen, Robin Cannon, Charlotte Bullock of Concerned Citizens of South Los Angeles, and Cynthia Hamilton, Laura Polito, Chris Mathis, and Kikanza Ramsey, and I at the Strategy Center published Reconstructing Los Angeles from the Bottom Up and worked together successfully to defeat the Weed and Seed program. This is one of Michelle's great strengths as an organizer of organizers, a glue figure, a group builder. And yes, among LA's strengths are the friendships among people who understand that political disagreements are not just okay, but a necessary part of the battle of ideas, and we truly appreciate the value of each other to a larger cause. Michelle models how charm and power are not antithetical and brings a sharp sense of political clarity to conversations focused on actually solving problems. When Michelle and Manuel Pastor did a study for Liberty Hill on the organizing tradition in L.A., Michelle came over to the Strategy Center to interview me, but it quickly moved from an interview to a conversation as we spent 3 or more hours talking. I was so impressed by her understanding of the theory and practice of organizing and her knowledge and memory of my work, often things I had not remembered at all until she reminded me. Today I worry that many people think organizing is a series of tasks and superficial relationships with the masses around an instrumentalist vision of social change. Knock on the door, explain an issue, get people, quote, involved, rather than a profoundly existential and deeply political relationship, as Barbara Lott Holland, the Strategy Center, says, is a connection among peers. Michelle understands that uniquely and well, and as another of organizer roles, brings that awareness into the funding world as an advocate for the dedicated organizers building movements on the ground. Glad to see you calling in. 818-985-5735. We're almost there. Sometime in 96, I was in New York and called into my office. They said Michelle Pritchard called and said it's important. I called her back immediately. She said, do you know the filmmaker Haskell Wexler? I was meeting with him, and he said he wanted to do a film about something revolutionary in Los Angeles. And I thought about you and the Bus Riders Union, that both your work and your outlook are consciously revolutionary. What do you think about him doing a film about your work? I said, are you kidding? Haskell Wexler of Medium Cool, Mate One, Underground, that Haskell Wexler? And I later learned the person who brought one of the greatest films of all time, The Salt of the Earth, to light, in his own underground production team against the McCarthy blacklist. Michelle, of course, I know who he is, and it's wonderful that you want to engage our work. Let's move on it right away. Michelle set up and participated in the first meeting with Haskell, Chris Mathis, and me. As usual, Michelle as an organizer put the package together, and from there it was up to all of us to make it happen. The making of the film Bus Riders Union and the wonderful friendship we built with Haskell and his wife Rita Taggart led to an 86-minute feature-length documentary which he financed generously with his own funds, and much more importantly, his brilliant labor. As the Zen Educational Project describes the film, hope is scarce in some videos with a conscience. In Bus Riders Union, it plays a starring role. The film was a critical tactic in our decades-long fight with the MTA that led to the victory of our Billions for Buses campaign. Thanks to the brilliant work of Connie Rice, Bill Ann Lee, and the NACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, and the great BRU leaders, Della Bonner, Ricardo Zalata, Norma Henry, Chris Mathis, Kikanza Ramsey, Rosalia Mendiola, Scott Miller, Pat Elmore, Barbara Lott Holland, Ted Robinson, Woodrow Coleman, our fight against the MTA's transit racism produced 2,500 compressed natural gas buses in L.A. instead of dilapidated diesel fleet, as the MTA was planning to phase out the bus system altogether. When we began that campaign in 1994, I called it Billions for Buses. Billions laughed at what they felt was hyperbole, but revolutions have to begin with high hopes and a transcendent vision. 10 years later, we had won $2.7 billion, with a B, in new buses and reduced fares for 500,000 L.A. bus riders. Without Michelle, we don't meet Haskell. Without Haskell, the film does not happen. Real people wake up and make real history. Today, all of us have to take a sober view of our work. Despite our great efforts and our work, our movement is not keeping up with the demands of history. Today, despite our best efforts, the conditions of black people in the United States, and I use this word with great care, are reaching genocidal proportions. Global warming is proceeding at a geometric and escalating rate. As capitalism's contempt for nature is nothing compared to nature's contempt for capitalism. All the human argumentation and rationalization cannot stop what Neil deGrasse Tyson calls the imperative of scientific truth, as the worst climate deniers are not the Neanderthal conservatives, but the moderates and liberals who preach about what is possible at a time when we must demand what is historically necessary. I know that organizers all over the country are in an introspective, self-critical, and innovative mood, and are willing to challenge and, if necessary, discard past assertions in search of the revolution that is historically required. Contrary to the facile and harmful assertion that the revolution will not be funded, in fact, all revolutions are funded by the poorest of the poor, people of significant means, and occasionally, even by the richest of the rich, who switch sides in the class war in the interest of a larger humanity. In that context, I do not know all the answers to the imposing issues of our time, but I'm clear that the long-distance runners and the experienced and gifted organizers like Michelle Pritchard, my dear friend, and foundations like Liberty Hill are essential to our future. Our biggest challenges and our best years are ahead of us. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines. I really want to thank you all. Let's go to the phones. Lynette in L.A., how you doing?
Hey. Hello. Thank you for taking my call, and a salute to you and to Michelle Pritchard and all the warriors out there doing the necessary work of justice and righteousness. Thank God for you.
Thank you so much.
Yes. And, you know, much like we need a third party in this country real desperately, and hopefully all of our little parties can get together and just make one, but we need a revival of the Human Rights Party with regard to just human, and then we can get on to civil rights and any other kind of rights, because it's kind of like the animals have more rights now, and I'm for animal rights, but, I mean, you have people that treat their dogs better than they treat people. In fact, the life of a black man is less than a dog, really. I mean, you see how a dog wouldn't even get beaten the way that some of the Latinos and blacks have been getting beat down and killed and shot. And, you know, in prison for 40 years without the hope of any kind of sunlight. And, of course, blacks, we don't produce vitamin D, which is very crucial to a lot of bodily functions and what have you. So it's really a crime against humanity, what we've been witnessing. So
Lynette, listen, I'm in that direction.
Hello?
Yeah, let me respond. There's some. Are you hearing static also? So I'm going to have to
stop and
respond to you, okay? Is it coming on our end or her end? Let me respond to what you said, Lynn, and thank you so much. You know, I'm sorry about the technical problems, because your actual ideas and delivery were wonderful. I've been doing a lot of thinking about that. I'm funny, you, not funny that you, we both think that. I also care about animal rights, but I have to say that the lack of concern for black rights is pretty shocking to me, especially, I'm not saying there's no black and Latino animal rights activists, but I especially see white animal rights activists outraged about whether or not an animal was harmed in a film, which is important, but they're not outraged about seeing a real black person shot down in cold blood by a policeman. So I definitely love that call. I also think that the concept of human rights, as Malcolm X said, as well as civil rights, so thank you very much for a very important call. Our next caller is Amelia in High Desert.
Hello. I want to thank you for bringing thoughts full of thoughts and active activists, and apologize if it may seem like there's a dearth of us out there, but you presented things so well. All I can add is that the opposite of, and this is not my quote, but maybe Gary Zukav said that the opposite of love is not hate, but apathy. So when we think of the battles we choose and the fact that, you know, I just might be the only last one with a radio and a landline, but these things that we're presenting and the more we can come together and, like Lynette said, get naked in the sun a little bit, suck your vitamin D, and maybe it's the fluoride in our water and maybe it's some of these mind-numbing substances, and I use the word broadly, just television, french fries, radio, you know, apathy. We have to stir ourselves up. Thank you for helping us do that.
Well, thanks a lot. That's a very good point. Radio, french fries, and television, I think that's a a pretty good observation. I think apathy, you know, as an organizer, it's so hard because I feed off other people's energy. I mean, I have phenomenal energy. I do. I've done this for 50 years. I know I still wake up in the morning sometimes too early, just outraged about what's going on in society. I haven't, seems to have an infinite capacity to work. But I could use some energy, too, coming towards me. I could use some energy, you know, the more people that call in on KPFK, the more interesting people that call, it raises my political hormones going. So thanks a lot for the call. I totally agree. Apathy is a terrible, French fries ain't that bad, TV, but apathy, man, that is the thing that could kill all of us. Moms on Long Beach, is that how you say it?
Hey, everybody, this is Morris. Hello, Professor. Listen, I believe I've been listening to a conversation where there's an absence of due process protections, not only with respect to asset forfeitures, but extrajudicial killings. And let's address the elephant in the room here. The war on drugs is the new Jim Crow. They use things like stop and frisk, broken windows, but they're all a face for the imprisoned industrial complex. And in terms of what should we do to address this, well, I kind of feel like the president, when they were asking him about the question of energy, and he said, all of the above, and that's what we need, all of the above. And if you want to talk about organized crime, take a look at your police departments. In Los Angeles, California, 55% of your budget is for law enforcement. You got to be kidding me. But I appreciate you taking my call, and y'all have a very good day.
Morris, thank you so much. You know, I completely agree, and we're going to tie up pretty soon. You're on Voices from the Frontlines. This is Eric Mann. Absolutely, 55% of the police budget. Mayor Garcetti just gave his so-called State of the City remarks, and in his State of the City remarks, he focused on the rising crime rate. What rising crime rate? I don't even know what he's talking about. I mean, the rising crime rate to me is the police. The rising crime rate is the unemployment. The rising crimes of homelessness and despair. And now he's talking about developing a very focused police department that's going to move into areas of high crime. This is just code for more occupying army in the black and Latino community. Is this another version of a SWAT team? Is this another version of a special forces? Very, very scary stuff. And we're going to take on Mayor Garcetti pretty fundamentally because we've tried to work with him. It's been 2 years. We've reached out to him. He clearly has a very corporate agenda, but the, you know, in our organization, Morris, we call it the privatizing, polluting, policing strategy that is the basis of L.A. And you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right that whether it's the war on drugs, the war on crime, it's fundamentally a war on black and Latino people. So when I was listening to Lynn Lyman, and we were having a little bit of a disagreement, because I totally, totally support the work they're doing. But to think that we're going to stop the police state, even, and I'm saying this for our own work, one piece at a time, I don't agree. I think there has to be a more fundamental assault on the police state ideologically. I think we have to call for the social welfare state, not the police state. I think we all have to talk about, here's an example. What if we all showed up and said, we want to free the U.S. 2.5 million, which is the prisoners. How many minutes we got? 2 minutes left. Oh, we got another caller? Oh, great. I want to take you, Robert and Ventura, get my last caller in. Thank you. Go ahead, Robert.
Yes, hello. I'd like to...
Talk a little lower, Robert. I got you.
Pardon me?
Just talk a little lower, but we got you. Go ahead.
Okay. Great, great. I want to direct people's attention to a very long time and dear friend of mine, Randy Hurley, who was instrumental in drafting and promoting and getting signatures and putting on the ballot Proposition 215, which Californians voted for medical marijuana.
And I'm going to have to take it. I'm going to try to listen. So we only have 1 minute left, and I'm very sorry. Some of you called in, whether it's our problem or yours, some of the reception hasn't been what we wanted. So let me say this to end. I want to thank our listeners who call in consistently. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines. We appreciate your support from KPFK. We support all the people that work at this station. We support the engineers. We support you. And I think increasingly, why I always go to the phones, it seems to be, is because I don't want to do a show where I don't know who's on the other end. It means so much to me to hear some human voices. So thank you for listening to my voice from the front lines. And I'm just realizing that every week, even if it's for 8 minutes or 10 minutes, I can promise that your voice will also be on Voices from the Frontlines. This is Eric Mann, your host. You're on KPFK 90.7 FM. Thanks for listening. Send me an email at eric@voicesfromthefrontlines. I'll be a happy guy. Send me a tweet at Eric Mann Speaks. See you next Tuesday at 4. Take good care of yourselves, and all power to the people.